sitting at a desk.
Yeah, we're sitting at a desk.
No escape from reality.
This is going to be podcast gold when you get all this.
Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see.
I'm just a poor boy.
Poor boy. I need no sympathy because it's easy come, easy go.
Little low.
Anywhere the wind blows doesn't really matter to me. To me.
Dun 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 dun
dun dun.
Mama, just kill the man.
Pull
the gun against his head.
Pull the trigger, now he's dead.
Mama,
life has just begun, and now I'm gone and thrown it all away. Mama,
the wind blows,
didn't mean to make you cry.
It's not
that back again this time tomorrow. Carry on.
Are we recording? Did we record that right now?
Or what?
In your face, Mikey Mason.
The multi-podcast Bohemian Rhapsody.
Down my spine.
That's my new podcast intro music, I think.
Yeah, you're going to steal it like I do.
It's Saturday, May 5th, 2012, and you're listening to a special episode of Fear the Boot, brought to you live from Fear the Con 5. We got a bunch of people on the mics today because we decided to do something a little bit different since we have a lot of podcasts that come out here and support us. We wanted to get them involved, so my name is Dan, and also from Fear the Boot, who else we got?
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
Okay, and let's start going down the road. Just give us your name and the podcast you're from.
This is Tim from Dice Food Lodging.
This is Josh from The Established Facts.
This is Mark from Rank S Game Design.
This is Keith from Kicked in the Dice Bags.
This is Jeb from Postcards from the Dungeon.
And I'm Mike from Action Nerds Go.
All right, now we've got a topic that Tim from Dice Food and Lodging brought up. So we're going to make him, in true Fear of the Boot fashion, explain his idea. And then we're going to get to kicking around on that. But there is something we have to settle first. And I don't know where John went to, but we got...
I just texted him.
Oh, there he is. All right, there's John, there's Pat. Hey, John and Pat, can you come down here?
Can you think to wear your sunglasses?
Like, come here. Come on.
Dun, 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 dun.
So,
if they don't fight, we will kill them both.
So,
Pat looks so lost and confused.
Thank you, Pat. You left your ice on the table over there. Now, the final tally is in, and it was a close vote. Now, I'm curious, who here thinks that the Pat soundboard should have been the winner? All right. What about John GMBot? Well, apparently you people do not vote like you cheer.
Oh!
52.8% to 47.2%, several hundred votes. Pat, you have won the Power 16-3. So,
that's
right. We're the carrying
podcast. All right, you guys head on off to the glory hole, and we'll catch up with you later. All right, so Tim, storytelling. I want you to set up for us what exactly we're talking about here. Storytelling, because obviously, role playing games in general are a form of storytelling. So, what's the angle here? What's the details?
So, the angle here is about improving the quality of your storytelling. I read a really fascinating article really recently about gaming with a blind person. Think about that for a second. You've got maybe your D&D minis out on a table, and you have a new person at the table who happens to be blind. No big deal. They already know the rules. And you're sitting around playing the game, and then somebody goes up to you and says, well, this is what my character looks like. Now, if you hold your hand in front of Wayne's face like this and say, this is what my character looks like, what do they see? They don't see anything. What you have to say, something like this, is my character is a tall, thin elven wizard. I've got dark black hair, pointy-tipped ears. I'm wearing a deep red velvet-colored robe. And really getting that vivid description into your storytelling vocabulary, into your gaming vocabulary. And I also recently went to an exhibition called Dialogue in the Dark, which takes you through a number of locations in New York City, you know, which is part of an exhibition, but they recreate a grocery store and allow you to experience a grocery store blind. Understanding what kinds of sounds, what kinds of smells really interact to create the picture and help you imagine the scenarios in your game.
So are you just talking storytelling, or is that more setting description?
Well, it's part of all of the storytelling, because at every point, you're not just describing a setting.
Right.
You're interacting with other characters, with the world. And every piece of your interaction with the other characters and the world and the NPCs can be that vivid and rich and descriptive. And when you can really bring that to bear on every moment of your game, every moment can be more gripping and powerful.
I agree with you to a certain extent, to a certain level. I really like putting a lot of detail and narrative into my game. I like putting a lot of atmosphere into my games. And I like doing a lot of descriptive work. And in fact, when I play other people's games, I think one of my biggest complaints with anybody I play is that they're just not giving me enough description. And I always want them to describe more and more and more. And I try to hold myself to a really high standard of giving a lot of description, too. And I feel that that's also one of my weaknesses. I don't give enough description. I want to give more and more. But I also believe that you can overdo it. I believe in the Alfred Hitchcock thing. You know, you give them just enough to get their imagination going. I mean, you don't want to describe every single little detail. I remember the Redwall novels. I tried to read the first one, and it was chapter after chapter after chapter of describing the food on the table, what the table looked like, the carving work on the table. It's like, okay, I get it. They're in a hall, and there's table and food. Let's get on with it.
You just don't want it to devolve into just this description after description after description of pointless thing.
You don't want it to devolve into that. You actually want, you have five people sitting around your table, and you want them to have five slightly different images in their mind of what you're talking about.
Dan's C.S. Lewis example is a good one, where he always talks about saying, there's a kitchen, there's a table, there are all the things you would expect to go along with a feast. What I expect to go along with a feast would be different than what Chad does, and each one of us are picturing it and getting more into that scene than if, say, you had described every single piece about it.
Right.
I love the details. I want the setting, but I, like someone else mentioned, I don't want it to drone on where you spend 5 minutes describing the setting. I know absolutely everything about it, and now I go left.
But you, on the other end, you also don't want you walk into a room.
Well, and that's exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, you get away from that. You walk into a 10-by-10 foot room, and there's a goblin in one corner. But if you have, you walk into a large square room, and there's a goblin who's dressed in like this red leather outfit that doesn't seem to fit him very well, and he's wielding a scimitar that seems to be dripping fresh blood, you get two very different scenarios for about 5 seconds more work.
Well, you also hit on something earlier when you're talking about things other than sight. I know that's one of the things that's my weakness, is I'll describe things, but I'll forget about the other things. Like the dripping blood, that can be a sound that you hear, the blood actually trickling as it hits the ground. Things like that, I think, really add to the scene, but it's the most forgotten things. It's one of the things when I was used to do a lot more writing, I would do exercises where I'd describe a room and just sit there and describe just purely this is how it looks. And then I would go somewhere and I'd sit down and I'd close my eyes and I'd listen and I'd describe what that situation was just purely with the other senses, because it's a weak spot. We are visual creatures, and it's really hard to think out of those terms of visual.
Those of us who can see are visual creatures. Now, we have a lot of people here who wear glasses, and if you take off your glasses, you have some trouble seeing. And yeah, at least a little bit.
Some
to varying degrees. Like, I'm
really lucky. I have very, very good, strong vision.
I pull my glasses back, and I'm not sure if that's Dan or a tree over there.
Exactly. And so the point is to start engaging more senses. Describe what a smell is like. And if your players have smelled that before, they can really integrate that into their sense memory and sense visualization of a scene. You describe brimstone, that burning sulfur smell, and you've got a lot more power to it. Sense is our strongest memory trigger.
I've got some thoughts on this that I want to throw out there, but first let's get someone else involved here. Go ahead and introduce yourself and fire away, sir.
I'm Sergeant Dan, ex-Sergeant Dan, USMC on the forums. One of the things that I was in a World War II submarine tour of an actual submarine, one of the things that they actually did to describe like the engine room and the smell of diesel was actually have a small can with a little pool of diesel. Because a lot of times you can hear what something smells like, but until you actually experience it, you don't get the full effect. Is there any way that you could bring those little props in? It doesn't have to be overpowering, just enough to trigger the mind and the imagination.
Well, personally, I always have a can of gas in my house for the players to smell. You know, that's powerful.
There's some scents that you just can't emulate, though. I run a lot of Cthulhu. How do you emulate the scent of a long dead corpse?
There's actually a couple of plants that emit that smell.
I was going to say the same thing.
But I don't want that in my house.
So, okay.
You don't keep them in your basement just for that?
First of all, check curiosity, is the submarine you're talking about the U-505 in Chicago, or is it a different one?
It was the one in San Francisco, the American sub. I can't remember the name of it right now.
I was just curious, because the one in Chicago, they do some things kind of like that, and they also simulate the engine noise to give you a sense of just how deafeningly loud it was in there, and how many of the submariners that worked in the engineering sections would come back from the war permanently deaf as a result of that noise. But, you know, Tim, there's kind of a subtopic to what you're getting at there that I think is worth underlining, which is you said that this came from dealing with a blind person. Then you start explaining it, and I asked you, okay, are we talking about setting or storytelling? And you kind of said, well, both. And it was at that point that really kind of hit me that there's a false dichotomy, I think, in the way that a lot of GMs approach their games. Myself included, if I'm not really conscientious about not doing this, which is you separate setting from action. That when you enter a room, there's setting, then action occurs, and the setting description stops. We go to the combat map, and all of a sudden it just becomes numbers and abstract actions. And any sense of a flow, any sense of an immersion, any sense of a reality that's built around that stops. And I think for even someone who is in possession of all five senses normally, you know, that's a bit abrupt. And so
that's the Final Fantasy effect I always talk about. Once the map comes out, all this immersion, all this you've got going in your head suddenly shifts to a top-down view.
One of the other things you may need to keep in mind it seems like everything that's being described here is the GM doing the description. One of the things that we've talked about even on our podcast is the idea of different systems, one of which we've talked about is the 7C system, which gives a lot of that power to the player. Okay, you walk into a room. Tell me what's going on. It's the player, is there a window? I don't know. The GM goes, is there a window? Because you're allowing the player to create that environment a little bit. Yeah, it sometimes gives bonus to the player, but let's look at it that way. Is there an advantage to the game master describing everything or giving some of that power to the players a little bit? Let the players describe some of it.
I absolutely love offloading as much work as possible onto the players and just sitting there and doing nothing when I GM. But I just got done with an Inspectors game, and that's what Inspectors is all about. Inspectors is just, you roll, you get high enough, which is not very hard to do, and the GM looks at you and goes, okay, you tell me, what happened? What do you see? Describe it to me. What does this look like? I go and I look for this magic tome so that I can dispel the ghosts. He's like, okay, describe the magic tome to me. What do you have? What is it? Player adds in all the details and such. It remains amazingly consistent through our whole game. For a 3-hour thing, we would come up with stuff at the beginning of like a mission or whatever that one person would drop a little detail that the player drops, and then that little detail gets spun off by another player, gets spun off by another player, and it builds this whole intricate setting and view that is shared by everybody. It really becomes very cool.
And I think this is one of the things that's really important as a GM and constructing what's generally referred to in academic circles as the magic circle that
puts you at a table in your gaming space. And that is to make each other responsible for nobody getting to slack off in your game. We had a great third slot with Kazel, Zeke, and Nathan. And we made sure that nobody slacked off in terms of their character motivations, and we all held each other accountable for that and said, okay, that's a little bit weak. Where's the power? Where's the motivation? And in that meshing of responsibility, we got an amazingly powerful game out of basically nothing.
We got another question here from the audience, and then I want these guys to talk, because I don't think they're used to pushing their way into a Fear the Boot episode.
Well,
so,
I was going to just say one thing real briefly, that simply put, getting on the players, encouraging them to create more of the world. I like the simple version of that Exalted has, where if you describe your actions in combat and stuff like that, you get stunt dice that add to your ability to do something a little bit more artistic and crazy and acrobatic maybe than you would normally get in other game systems. So
I'm Church, and it's like everybody has been saying, it's a group effort. It really is. So one thing I want to propose to you guys is that what happens when somebody, as you've mentioned before, what happens when somebody is lacking behind in the whole storytelling? And then what happens if somebody gives too much? Because I've been in that game system and that game group where it's that one guy that keeps going on and on.
Wait for it. Cut.
That's all
done. I've been doing a lot of live action Scandinavian Jeepform freeform gaming recently, and that's something the GM is explicitly given directive to do. Cut. Scene ends. The tension is there. You cut at a scene of high tension. You go into the next scene. You've set the baseline for the next scene, and it gets more powerful and more powerful and more powerful.
You realize what you've done here. Now for the next year, you're going to hear Chad complaining because we all keep saying, cut.
I think this is important. But it's an important technique. As in you as a GM, don't let your players ramble on and on about something that basically nobody's having fun doing, but they feel that they have to keep talking and doing. Cut.
I think that in a collaborative game where there's a lot of player control over the narrative and the setting and such, when you have a GM in one of those types of games, it's the GM's job to keep the flow going. And even if it's not an indie game, it's the GM's job to make sure the spotlight is shared. That it's either on everybody or it's on one person and then another person and then another person. Everybody gets their fair share. So if you have a person who's like me or Adam Godfrey, who are these alpha players who just steamroller everybody else, and we don't know that we're doing it, it's definitely up to the GM.
Yeah, I never get to talk.
What's that?
I never get to talk.
Cut.
Totally using that.
As someone who comes from a background in forum gaming mostly, one of the GMs I played under actually had a really cool idea. He says, you want more than 50 words, but less than 300. And I always try to keep that with me whenever I'm playing. Keep myself expansive, but brief.
Pendragon on the forums, and I have a different question about a lot of the ways to describe something is with similes or metaphors and things like that. But I have an international gaming group of, an Italians, Frenchmen, Japanese, and, Americans. How would you explain things to them? Because I'll be it's like being stuck on the freeway. And they're like, we've never been to a freeway. We've never been to America. We have no idea what it is. And I find that's a real hassle because that's a natural way that we're taught in school how to describe things.
Being at a restaurant behind a sumo wrestler.
Or not every game is a fantasy game, but if you take things down to the simplest form, country roads, everyone's seen a road on the country or seen somewhere that vehicles go. But if you need to take things down to the simplest possible form, when nothing was electronic, whatever, make it simple. People want simple things because it's easier to understand simple. But if you have a group of people, like all of us who understand, we make gaming jokes all the time. No non-gamer will understand those. But if you can make the comparable joke in a simpler form, they'll catch on.
Well, you want to make it simple, but you also need to keep it very evocative. That's part of getting back to the storytelling and showing up with descriptions that are going to trigger something, even in somebody who can't see. The words that you use need to be evocative and descriptive and vivid to plant that image in your players' heads. But that doesn't mean it has to be long and drawn out. A few simple phrases will do it. And just coming up with those ahead of time for each room or each area that's important,
That could be huge, you know, to making it, to making it good.
Playing off the metaphor thing, I'm curious, Tim, this blind individual, were they born blind or did they go blind at some point during their life?
I think in the article that I read, it was a person who was born blind.
Okay.
So no sight at all.
Yeah, that goes into what I was going to say. It's all about context. I mean, we've got a friend who has no sense of smell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just smell that we have a problem describing to him, but taste.
Smell is 40% of taste.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's really hard sometimes if you don't know that context about what the person does or doesn't already know to get some of this out there.
I see, because I think it would be very hard. For example, color conveys emotion. I was running the Gingers Have No Souls game yesterday, which is, of course, a comedy game. But I was trying to put that comedy against the somewhat intentionally dry, humorless background of Nordic mythology. So when you guys went down to Helheim, I described the place as being very gray and green and brown and whatnot. And that conveyed a certain emotion. But if I had never seen those colors, and the only approach that I can think of, and maybe some of these guys or you guys will have other approaches, is I think about it the other direction. I am in full possession of five senses, okay? I have a little bit of issue with smell and a little bit of issue with sight, but more or less I'm functioning in five senses. However, I have played characters who are supposed to have other senses. For example, in Shadowrun, I've played mages who are capable of us-sensing or astral sensing, played characters who are supposed to be psychic. I was just playing in a game called Apocalypse World yesterday in first slot, where there was something called, I think, the maelstrom of the mind or something to that effect, where you got tapped into this sort of this chaos of this kind of otherworldly stuff. And I recall that as that was being described in all these games, they used metaphors from senses I did possess. They might say, oh, well, there's a chill that cuts you to the bone, or it's like the memory of something else, or you feel like you're in a dream, or it looks like this, and they describe it in terms of the five senses I do possess. And I wonder if there would be some way, in the same way, to translate setting into the other senses, first of all, for a handicapped player, but secondly, even if you're playing with a group of people who have all five senses, if that, Wayne, per your writing exercise, would be a way to keep you strong and not just using sight. Say for a minute, okay, how would I describe this to someone who couldn't see? And maybe not turn that into my template, but tool in the toolbox, say this is something I could use in the right situations to maybe describe a royal hall in terms of its sounds and smells with only a little bit of its imagery.
Now, there's one thing I have against that is that there are some senses that don't work into each other. You can't use feel to describe scent. You can use taste to describe scent. You can use sight to describe scent, maybe, but feel, definitely not. And, like, hearing to taste, etc.
I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you pretty strongly on that. If you don't know, my background, I went to school for winemaking. Like, I have an enology degree. And the language used to describe wine is full of, like, flavors and odors. But when you sort of get practiced and, like, get into it, you start getting into evocative memories as well. I've described a wine as tasting like a volcano. And if you think about what that might mean, it's a white wine that tastes like a volcano. So there's a lot of sort of this rich, weird, sulfury, earthy element to it that doesn't taste like what you expect out of wine. And as Dan is describing, it's a tool. It's a tool, and it's something to be aware of that lets us grow as game masters, creating better situations for storytellers and creating our ability to interact with other people.
When you said that it tastes like a volcano, that is not at all what I thought. I thought you meant an explosion of flavor.
Interesting.
And then that was just a generic thing for me.
Well, there are other ways, though, that people, I mean, for a long time have used other versions of senses to describe things. Like, every artist in this room knows what I mean when I say warm colors or cool colors, you know? Photographers will know that same way. And if you talk to somebody and say, well, why is red a warm color? It's because when things get hot, when you have hot metal that you're, like, smelting, it's going to get hot and orange, you know, and red and stuff like that. So the way to describe things is by association, intrinsically. You can't just come up with a way of explaining something that has no relationship to something that's already known.
I understand what you're saying, but my point was that you can't tell me that something tastes how something tastes because it's plaid colored.
But
this is true.
You're proving the point that just between everything that just happened right now, the power of the mind is going to make things come out completely different based off your description. And I think that's one of the biggest bonuses about what it is we all are here talking about. You got to let the players, you're giving them descriptions, but as someone said, you don't want to describe too much. You got to give them enough to where their brains can, because I'm telling you, you can describe the exact same situation to three different people and get five different opinions. It's just how it works out. So we have to allow that to happen, but that's part of the fun. But as a player or a game master, if you're not sure, that's when you ask questions. That's when you find out. That's when you get clarification.
This is John Wells, TriggerHappy938 on the forums. We've all come to this agreement that bringing this level of description to the game table is a good thing, and we've come forward with a solution to how to deal with it when it's taken overboard. What do you do?
Was that saying anything?
What do you do for the player who gets that decision paralysis when they give you the nondescript description? You're like, well, I use the nondescript magic tome. Well, what does it look like?
I jump in and help them out, straight up.
Like, give them small
details.
So
it's a chair. I think maybe it's like a wooden chair with a curved back and like spokes
and
in it.
Over the long term, that's a good, you know, short term when they lock up. What advice would you give for improving yourself as a player if you find yourself having trouble with this?
I would say a lot of times, especially when I was a new player, when I would say, like your example, a magic tome, to me, that's just two words, magic tome. There's not an item, there's not an object that was associated with those two words. Now, as a more experienced gamer, when you say magic tome, I instantly get a picture in my mind exactly what it looks like. I have like a brown, thick, you know, book with like buckles on it and all this stuff like that. I can immediately get all those details because that's what that term means to me. And that doesn't mean that that's what it means to everybody, but it gives me a starting off point that even if I don't describe it, if a GM were to ask me, well, what does this tome look like? I have a pictorial representation in my mind. And I would say that to get people to be able to do that is simply ask them to picture it in their mind, and eventually it'll become a habit. The GM won't have to pry for details. If you sit there and go, what does this thing look like before I talk about it, you know, and you get into the habit of that, then it just becomes second nature, at least to me.
So I would also go back to what I said when talking about six senses, which is going from the known to the unknown. I'd say, you found a magic tome, describe it to me. They and oh, they have no idea. I'd say, okay, what is the last really old book you saw? Describe it to me. I think that does two things. Of one, it gives them a framework that's personal. But secondly, that may also kind of teach them a little bit in the future when you ask them for something like that again, where to start looking, where to start drawing from.
Well, I think it depends on what the issue is. I mean, one thing you want to avoid, you don't want to put someone on the spot and make them uncomfortable so they're afraid of that next moment. Depending on what
don't leave them hanging.
Depending on what that issue is, I like to actually ask more leading questions. Let's say, okay, you found a magic tome, and I ask you to describe it, and you don't have a quick description. Start asking specific questions. Okay, what color is it? Are the pages worn? Are the pages yellow? Actually lead them to that description, so next time they know what you're looking for when you ask for it.
Yeah, well, so
it's
it should
a lot
only
easier
happen
to
one
say
time
brown than it is describe the whole thing.
It won't happen. The thing is not everyone's going to retain every single time you go through the description. What's going to happen, though, is you're going to start giving them reminders throughout it as well. I love that approach. I've got nothing. So you ask them, what color? Or you give them a frame of reference. I like how you mentioned that. But the big thing about it is you've got to allow the player to visualize it the best way they know how, which really is only going to happen with both you as a game master experience with that player and that player's experience in the world, as it may be. Because every day, you know, now somebody's like, do you know what this is? We can go do a Google search. But you don't always have a Google search in a role-playing game. So as a game master, you make it a point. If you're going to ask somebody to describe something, you better be ready and willing to describe it yourself as well. Don't ask them to describe something that doesn't exist.
For major points, too, like maybe, you know, an easy one to say is like character creation, stuff like that. If you go on Obsidian Portal and post a picture that, you know, a drawing or a photo that you can find of something, that way that everybody has the same common experience of what your character looks like. And that doesn't work for everything. Obviously, if you're playing like a big, you know, monster thing, you may not find exactly what looks like for your character. But if you're playing most games or you're playing a human or something close to it, usually I've been able to find close approximations of what I feel my character looks like somewhere on the giant internet. And then if I post that on like Obsidian Portal or something, everybody goes, oh, I know exactly what he's going for with his character, you know. But like I said, you could possibly use that for objects or weapons or whatever like that, but it's easiest, I think, with characters, but it's an option.
Hey, this is Dan from CarpeGM.net.
Rovanian on the forums. Regarding descriptions and whatnot, I think it needs to be said that it is possible to give a description for something that is too set in stone. The minute you say something looks like a Terminator, everybody is putting that universe in play. Everybody has that in their brain. Now, if that's not your setting, that could be a problem. The minute every dwarf sounds like
Gimli. Scotty.
Yeah, Gimli or whatever.
Scotty,
that's
nice.
That's something that can't be undone for the rest of your game. So it is possible to give a piece of information that brings a specific reaction and a specific thought into your player's mind that may not mesh with what you're trying to convey in your game. What do you guys think about that one?
I actually run into that problem all the time when I run Lucid, my Inception game, because invariably I will always get at least one player who's never actually seen the movie Inception.
Right.
And when you start describing the world to them and the unreality of it and how they think it's a reality, and then there's the subconscious projection, then there's the guys in suits trying to get them, first thing that comes to their mind, Matrix.
Yeah.
And then they start thinking Mr. Johnson's, they start thinking, and then they start making suppositions beyond that, that they could do all the stuff that they could do in Matrix, and that's not exactly true. It's a different world. It has a different set of rules. It has a different...
First time I played it, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
You describe these things. I think they're agents in the Matrix. We can't fight these things. We just have to run.
Yeah.
And that's not his intention in there.
Yeah.
So just that description completely threw off the feel he was going for.
Really, the best way to deal with that is to head it off at the pass. If you see them going down a path, a sort of narrative path that you're not intending... you don't want, correct them. I mean, you don't have to be like a jerk about it or anything, but, you know, just kind of say, no, it's not like that, it's like this. And if you do a lot of early sort of front-loaded corrections at the beginning of your game, then that will be corrected, so the entire rest of the game will be fine. Instead of playing like with what happened with Wayne, we played the entire frigging game, and he's doing all these, like, run, like, and by the end of the game, I'm like, why are you running from these guys? You know you could just pull a cannon out of your pocket and destroy them. And he's like, oh, I thought these were like the Matrix guys and we couldn't kill them. I'm like, oh, no, I should have said something.
Yeah, and sometimes it can be just one word. In the first time you ran Silent Memories for us, I ask, are there sensors? You're thinking Star Trek sensors, magical sensors that can detect everything. And I'm asking, do we have infrared sensors? Can we see movement in the ship?
And
basically, that one word meant something different to me than it did to you. It almost changed the whole feel of the game.
And because of that, all the subsequent games I run of Silent Memories, one of the first things I say is, there are no sensors like Star Trek sensors in my game, because people make that jump. You know, there's no woo-woo-woo and...
No tricorder.
I think what we're getting at here is to aim for specificity and simplicity of language.
A common frame of reference.
Exactly, to create a common frame of reference. Like, Absolutely. Don't use... words that are loaded down with meaning, like, oh, this golem is sort of like the Terminator, which means something crazy huge. What I mean, like, it's like a dude who's like looks like liquid metal.
Avoid describing anything with something that's trademarked. If it's trademarked, it automatically comes with context.
And Cutwing. My name's Paul, SD Poet from the forums, from my three or four posts. But what I was actually going to get into was just, you guys are talking a lot about assumed idioms, that if I say you walk into a room and two orcs are drinking, the native English speakers are going to assume I mean alcohol, but someone who doesn't really have that idiom may just think that they're sipping something from some kind of a container. You get into the same thing when you talk, you know, you kind of started off with someone who's blind may not know that blue is serene and red is angry or something like that, but over time they may learn, I hear the word red and I know that means passion or fire or anger, but you don't really feel it, you just kind of memorize it at some point. And so a lot of these things that you guys seem to be talking about deal with just assuming that two people have the same initial idioms to express something.
I think it's more about creating those initial idioms to make sure that you have that shared space rather than assuming it. Because when I say, this is what my character looks like, you know, that means one thing to somebody who can see a mini that I painted, and it means something else to somebody else who cannot see it. And so it's about creating that shared space.
What I feel is that when you first say it, let's say this is the first time I'm going to describe red, I'm going to say he's red with anger, he's red fuming. If I use extra words to tack a meaning onto it, if I in the future say it's red with whatever, then they will know that that's what I mean.
Well, a lot of these, too, are really specific kind of issues. You know, you're talking about people from other countries or people with maybe some sort of sight or, you know, other kind of sense disability. All in all, those things, I think, can be mainly addressed specifically because I don't think that they're very common for the majority of gamers or gaming groups. You know, now, that's not to say that they're not out there. They definitely are, but it's just not the common thing. What I think is probably the most important is that everybody should be on the same page, and if they're not, they need to let the rest of the group know. Either the GM, if the GM doesn't understand what the gamers are doing, or the gamer doesn't understand the setting that the GM is putting forth, whatever that is, if you don't feel like you're on the same page with everyone else, don't be embarrassed and go, oh, well, I guess I'll just figure it out. Ask somebody. This is a social, you know, hobby. It's a social group. People will, you know, put more information out there.
It's a social experiment with rules.
Absolutely. And so people want to describe things. They want to make sure that everybody's on the same page. And I think that if you just make sure that you're, you know, put your hand up and go, hey, wait, you know, that's...
And I want to make sure that we remember that on the internet, we are a global community full of blind people, deaf people, people from every country in the world. This is really important because we're interacting like this all the time and maybe not thinking about it.
Grant Saragon on the Fear the Boot forums and elsewhere. We've talked a lot about static things, people. How can you be evocative in describing action? What is happening as opposed to what is there? Do you have any advice for that?
One of the first things that I did when I started GMing was to steal outright from novels that I love to read. Take descriptions, you know, read. I mean, and we're all reading all the time. I assume that anyway. And so, you know, you're always finding phrases that you like or descriptions of scenes that you think are cool. Steal that. I can't think of the number of times that I used the phrase, you know, he moved like a puma, because I had read the Conan novels umpteen times when I was, you know, in middle school. I hope that my style has gotten a little bit better since then, but the same thing applies. And then you'll start to make up your own poetry for the movement of...
I disagree.
Yeah, okay, maybe that's not possible. Okay, I get that. But, you know, then once you've absorbed enough of that and seen how it works with different situations, you'll start to make up your own poetry of the action as it goes.
Yeah. You gain words the more you read words.
Another thing is try narrating a scene of a movie that you like. I mean, try describing a Matrix fight just with words to somebody. I mean, there's a lot going on there, and visually it's incredible, but how do you describe that to your players?
Are you suggesting practice?
Yeah.
Yes,
I am.
Practice is
yes,
important.
I am.
So I recently interviewed R.A. Salvatore, the fantasy writer who has written umpteen million books.
Is that how you say his name?
R.A. Salvatore.
Salvatore, okay.
Salvatore, yeah.
Okay.
He comes from a background in technical writing, and he describes combat scenes as technical writing, where you describe each piece of it instructionally. Simple as that. That is where he draws from for all of his combat scenes.
I feel like every player who wants to play in a game should have to sit down and write one page of action. That way you can learn what your limits are, what you can do. You know, if you learn inside, then you can use it in game.
And buy a thesaurus. Use synonyms. That's what they're there for. English has got like 1.5 million words, and we don't need them all except for description. Instead of saying, I stabbed this guy, I stabbed this other guy, I stabbed this other guy, you have to be able to thrust your sword or, you know, swish it through the air or, you know, cleave or, you know,
read the Iliad.
Other things, you know?
Read the Iliad. Read poetic battle stories. Read Beowulf. These are huge.
Speaking of the international...
Something that I would add to that, but first I have a request. Could somebody go out and seek Johan for me? I don't see him in this room, but we need Johan. Oh, thank you. Well, they're doing that. Something I was going to add to that is that action...
They should go read everything on skiesofglass.com?
Yeah.
Also. Plug.
Wow, cheap plug.
Yeah.
Oh. It was even better because you missed it.
Oh, yeah, there's that thing.
Hey, Chris isn't here to do it for himself, and he's the one currently throwing stuff up there.
So no.
Someone's got to do a cheap pop for
okay,
Chris.
Okay, fine. You can do... cheap pop for Chris and your stuff. That's fine. But no, what I was going to say is that action, like everything else, also has multiple senses. If you swing a sword at somebody, yes, there's obviously a visual to that. There's also a feel of wind. There might be a smell of the steel, or if it cuts you, obviously there's a feeling to it. There might be a scent to it. Yeah, and of course, this is going to vary from action to action. Something like cooking, for example, appeals to a lot more senses, and we're much more familiar with it. I would presume more of us have been around cooking and eating and halls packed with gamers than we have been around getting stabbed. But nonetheless, these things do appeal to multiple senses.
Well, they also get back to what you were saying earlier, Dan, about the combat takes place in an environment, not on that battle mat. You were talking about how once you go to the minis in the battle mat, the description of the room can disappear because everybody's focused on that. I try to limit the number of times I use minis or the battle mat so that it is more of a descriptive, all-encompassing experience for the players.
Gamma Ray on the forums, Ray Dixon. As someone who's been in combat in the Society for Creative Anachronism, I can vouch for the fact that you're smelling not only rusting steel, you're smelling your old sweat. You're smelling the grass that you're crushing underfoot, or oops, just stepped in something my horse left. That sort of thing.
Well, smell, too, is one of those important things that I think gets left out. And we were talking about it earlier, but smell is what they generally attribute that's most associated with memory. So if you're trying to get an evocative response from players, especially, if you can use smells and stuff like that and it's something that they have a memory of, a lot of times that will bring out something more than just describing, you know, what a sword looks like or something like that.
In all the role-playing that I've done, scent might be the one sense that I've used the least because it's ridiculously hard.
Yeah, it's very difficult to convey.
And don't be afraid, like Gamera was saying, you know, don't be afraid to do the sweat, the stink, the stench and stuff. I like putting in the sort of visceral, disgusting sense descriptions into my games because they stick with a player. I mean, it kind of like really makes a scene pop, and it's not so much that it makes it real and it more immersive, but it makes it poignant. It's like the exclamation point when describing a scene. It kind of makes it memorable and stand out.
It's like getting everyone at Chris's BattleTech game to fart.
I was about to say, you know, sometimes it's helpful to make your own smells.
We're going to have to wrap this one up here pretty soon because we need to start taking this down, and I need to start getting ready for my slot 5 game, as I'm sure several other people do. But before we do, there's something here I'm told we have. Now, we see Johan's here. I don't see John. So, Johan, you don't have to respond because your counsel's not present, but we just want to present you with some evidence. So, Chris, would you care to go ahead and explain what we have to present to the man?
Well, hailing from a state where both the Insane Clown Posse and Faygo were invented, and where it is not, being a juggalo does not carry such onerous ramifications as in the state of Missouri, we wanted to show our support and solidarity for someone, even if you are or are not a juggalo, as is yet to be determined. We love you anyway. So to present to you and to the podcasters, we have brought a case of Faygo from Michigan to let everybody have a taste of the deliciousness, and we love you, man.
So we have actual Faygo for our
totally called the orange
juggalo.
Soda.
I already ate.
It's a trap.
I would like to say that were we doing this properly, this bottle should be shaken up and sprayed across the crowd. That is the proper way to do it, but
if I drink this, will I know how magnets work?
No,
they're miracles.
You will no longer remember how magnets work.
Wow.
I'm sorry, we got one other thing here as well.
For those of you who don't know, I'm from Japan, and I flew out here for the con for this weekend. And one thing, I just want to thank you guys. I listen to most of the podcasts you guys do, and I want to just thank you because it's the only real input I get from non-scripted English. You know, some more non-scripted than others. And so I wanted to bring something from Japan. And Japan is not famous for inventing things. They're famous for taking things and making them their own. So what I have here is wasabi Kit Kat bars.
Oh, man.
Give me a break.
Yeah. For you guys, the host there.
Give me one on that one.
Make that disappear.
They might have melted a little on the plane, but they should be fine.
Domo arigato gozaimasu.
Yeah. Come on, Chad. Step up.
Eat them all at once.
He's trying.
No way. I want one, too.
Good Lord. How long do you want the fade-out music to be? Well, tune in next time to find out if Chad ever actually ate one or not. So, I do want to thank you all for coming to FreelyCon 5. I want to let you know that As always, I have been making my rounds between the vendors, the kitchen, the drink people. They say you've been taking great care of them. We're showing them a lot of respect, tipping well. Keep it up. You guys are awesome people. And, no, Derek's got one last thing, and then we're going to close this one out.
Just wanted you guys to know that so far we have raised over $600 for Gamers Outreach for a small con. That is incredible. Thank you, guys.
Awesome. As for those of you at home, ha ha ha, you should.
So, take that wasabi.
So we've got a.
It's really kind of good.
It's really good. So it's a white chocolate with a very gentle horseradish.
So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time. See ya.